What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devinder Hardwar. Joining me today is Senior Writer Sam Rutherford. Hey, Sam.
Hey, how you doing? Good to be back.
Good to have you back. Sherlyn is, I believe she's getting some sort of mouth surgery right now. So, you know, maybe not the best position to podcast, but
kinda,
we'll have
kind of hard to talk when your mouth hurts.
It's going to be tough. I think it's a root canal for Sherlyn. So everybody send her your well wishes. But this week, we've got a couple cool topics. Sam has been at the New York Auto Show, so he can report back about the cool stuff he saw there, especially some of the EVs and some stuff from Polestar. We've got a bunch of different news. Also, Sherlyn has a new interview with Lucy Liu, the actor who stars in the new VR game, The Pirate Queen. So stay tuned for that. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes and drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. So, Sam, I figured this would be a great episode to dive into our thoughts about the state of EVs and where things are going this year. You just attended the New York Auto Show, and I know you saw a bunch of cool cars, and you're doing some car coverage for us now, too. Can you give us, like, a quick recap of the coolest things you saw and, you know, what you think of EVs at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of talk about, like, you know, the whole shift to EVs. There's been some pullback. Yeah. Kind of sales were down at the beginning of the year, but they seem to have picked back up. And now the kind of big focus is, like, there's a lot of charging anxiety. It comes, like, you know, EV owners, you know, are just like, I'm not going to have enough charging ports. And, you know, between that and the shift to the NACS adapter for some vehicles, people are really just like, if I, you know, even though my car supports it, like the, you know, Ford Mustang Mach-E, if I go to a Tesla supercharger, am I going to actually be able to use it? And so I think, you know, there's some anxiety around that.
But can we break that? Let's take a step back. Can we break that down a bit? Because we saw some stories, Sam, at Engadget about, like, Tesla opening up its charger ecosystem. That's something that's been in the works for a while. Even Rivians can access that now, right?
Yeah. So at least in North America, Europe is a different story. You know, pretty much all of the EV manufacturers have agreed to use the quote unquote Tesla adapter, which is officially called, they changed the name to the NACS adapter. And then just recently, Ford, announced a thing where they're able to, they're going to give out a free complimentary adapter from the old CCS adapter to NACS. So, you know, you'll be able to do that and you can get one for free. And, you know, Hyundai and, other companies are kind of doing something similar. And so they're in the process of either giving people adapters or on upcoming, mostly 2025 year vehicles, they will have the NACS adapter just installed, by default. So it's nice to see that, like, hey, we're finally picking a plug standard that everyone can use. The issue is that, like, depending on where you're at and, you know, if you have the adapter yet or if your, you know, automaker even supports it, it might still be, you know, in the works. It can be difficult to figure out, like, hey, does my adapter work with, Tesla's stuff yet? Or do I have to rely on, you know, old school chargers and then kind of the, you know, in-betweens of that? And I have heard some reports that, and this is actually pretty recently because that just happened a few weeks ago, that some of the people with the adapter for their Mustang Mach-E still can't use Tesla superchargers in certain areas just because of, like, congestion and the way that rollout is happening. So there are definitely some kind of pain points as, you know, the charging infrastructure gets built out.
It's a common complaint. I watch a lot of, like, car YouTubers as well, and their main thing is, like, they will go to a charging location, you know, and things will just not be working. Like, that's the thing I've seen. Like, I have seen more EV stuff deployed throughout my community and my city, but whenever I'm testing an EV and I try to go use it, those things are often down. There's often software issues. And especially when doing, like, plug-in hybrids, it's always tough to tell, like, will this charger actually have the thing that can plug into my thing?
Right.
It is super confusing. Far more confusing than, like, choosing, you know, than pumping gas into your car. And I think that's a whole thing this industry has to deal with. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, you know, that's what, you know, Tesla's historic advantage is, hey, they made it easy. They have the biggest charging network. And so, you know, right now, like, that's kind of how it is. And, you know, hopefully, you know, that changes. And so right now for most people, if you have a garage and you have the ability to put, like, a level 2 charger in your garage, that's great because then you can sidestep all that. You don't really have to worry about it unless you're going on a road trip. And then, you know, most of the times people, you know, if you have two cars, maybe you take the gas car for the road trip anyways. But if you're like me and you live in like an apartment building and you don't have, you know, like a dedicated parking space or a garage, that's when things get really dicey. And unfortunately, that's like, you know, sad, because the perfect use case for a lot of EVs is as a city car, where you're not doing high mileage trips all the time, but you want something efficient that's easy to pick up and go. And then, hey, maybe every 2 or 3 weeks you have to charge it once. And then you run into that issue of like, I got to know like firsthand, like, can I trust this charger? Can I, you know, and where, you know, the closest chargers are. And that's kind of the issue.
I think around Atlanta, I see a lot of people, I see people at the Tesla chargers all the time, which makes me think people are buying these cars and don't have the setup at home to do it right. They're apartment dwellers and they don't have the garages either. Even in my house, like I don't have a level 2 charger, but when I test a plug-in hybrid or even some hybrids, I do the level 1 thing. I plug it in and it sits overnight. And for city driving, you know, that gets you, if it's overnight for like 8 to 10 hours, charging up, that's like 30 miles, you know,
which for sure. And you can even get
a lot of people could do the thing. Yeah.
And depending on it, like if you can do at home charging with a 240 volt plug, which is like, you know, your, what you usually use to like plug in like a gas, or I mean, not a gas range, like a stove or like a washing machine, you can get even more. And you can usually, for a lot of people, you can probably get by with just that. But it, that just requires like, you know, a little bit more familiarity with like how much driving range you're going to do and stuff like that. And so it just gets a little bit in the weeds for a lot of people. And then, you know, you can see that said, you know, I went to they had a kind of forum talking about New York State is like, hey, they installed a bunch of fast chargers at JFK and they're, you know, they got really popular really fast. And it makes a lot of sense because, hey, you have Uber drivers who have EVs and, you know, it really helps them out. And they're, you know, they're going to install like a 13 charger system at LaGuardia. And they have, you know, made sure that like they're committing to, hey, every 50 miles on the highway in New York State, there will be some sort of fast charger. And so it's nice to see that, like, you know, even local municipalities, they get it. And so it's going to take some time to, you know, install these chargers, but it seems like the momentum is, you know, starting to grow a little bit in terms of like, hey, even locally, you should have more availability for charging networks.
It is weird, like the state of the EV market at this point, because I saw the reports about sales slowing down overall for EVs, but I think partially that may be due to the new like tax credit rules, you know, where if you're not buying, if it's not built in the US and if it's not using a battery from the US, you don't get the full tax credit. What I have noticed is that people in the car communities are talking more about leasing an EV and kind of the wisdom of doing that. For one thing, like if you lease an EV, that full tax credit gets put into the lease, so that is interesting. It kind of it doesn't matter if it's actually manufactured in the US. And also this tech you're talking about, battery tech changing, charging tech changing, this stuff is changing so quickly right now, it kind of makes sense to just be like, if you want an EV, maybe just pay a monthly fee for it to have the latest thing, and in a couple of years you'll be ready with an even, you'll be able ready to move up to a different platform, maybe a different charging thing, and hopefully this will all stabilize right now. But for a lot of people, it seems like leasing is a good option if you want something new.
Yeah, and that also kind of sidesteps the issue of depreciation, because Tesla has been doing a ton of price cuts recently, and that has really impacted the value of used EVs, which have, you know, you're seeing like huge, like, you know, 50% in just a year. I mean, that's not uncommon, but like, you know, you're seeing pretty heavy depreciation, especially for Tesla EVs. So, you know, leases traditionally not the most like economical way, because you're paying for, you know, that flexibility, but in this case it might make a little bit more sense.
Or buy a used Tesla that isn't too beat up. Like I have my issues with the company, with Elon Musk at this point, but also I'm a deal hound, so it's like if for some reason a Model X or something, well, I don't like the doors, but if something was really cheap and was a good deal, it's like, I would not blame anybody for jumping on that. Certainly you get good infrastructure. You get good charging infrastructure too. Can you talk about like, what were the coolest things you saw at the show, Sam?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, let's, you know, continue the EV discussion. I think the car that I was most excited for, and we're gonna have a write up on the site, pretty soon before the end of the week, is we saw the Polestar 4, which is, Polestar's kind of more affordable, slightly smaller sibling to the Polestar 3. And They just came out with official pricing for the first time. Previously, they said it was going to be around $60,000. And yesterday, they announced that it was going to be even less than that, starting at around $56,300, including destination for the single motor variant. And then it's going to be around $63,400 for the dual motor all-wheel drive variant. And so, it's nice to see that, like, things are actually coming in cheaper than expected. And this is, like, great for Polestar because they announced price cuts for the Polestar 3 as well. Mm-hmm. So that dropped
Let's be clear. The Polestar 3 is kind of a sedan, right? That is a traditional sedan?
No, the Polestar 3 is a kind of traditional EV SUV.
Okay.
And then the Polestar 4 is also an EV SUV, but slightly more compact, slightly more coupe style. So
it looks
a little
almost
bit shorter.
Like a hatch. Yeah.
Yeah, it almost looks like a taller sedan kind of hatchback thing. But they're both, you know, in the, like, SUV, EV category.
Right. That's kind of where everything is right now. And this car, I remember everybody was talking about because it doesn't have a rear window. And that
yes.
seems like a problem.
And so it's interesting because in the U.S. at least, there are regulations where cars must have side view mirrors. But if you think about it, there's no regulation for rear view mirrors or even a rear window. Uh-huh. You think about it, it's like, oh, that sounds kind of scary, but you think about it, there are tons of cargo vans, like, you know, HVAC
yes,
technicians
yes.
who drive around all day, don't have issues because they just have, you know, a cargo van with metal in the back.
Well, they also have big, those things back up, they make noise. Like, they alert everybody to be like, hey, something's coming through here. And mm-hmm. that's not necessarily true with even a car, yeah.
Or that's true. But, I mean, the thing is that it's not like they haven't thought about it, right?
Right.
So
right.
instead of having no rear window, they have a camera in the back, and then they have a rear view mirror with a display embedded so that you still get, you know, your full rear view. And this actually, you know, it might sound scary, but it makes a lot of sense because
I get it, yeah.
Number one, the rear view visibility of a lot of these coupe kind of sloped back SUVs is already really, really bad because
yeah,
they have the,
yeah.
you know, the roof line drops down and they have tiny rear windows as it is. And then you have the seats to deal with and any passengers who might be in the back seat. And so, hey, let's just give people a really great view with a camera. And then that actually has a ton of other benefits because, you know, by not having those pillars in the back where, you know, the window kind of to support the window, they can move the seat back so you get more legroom in the back. You can, you know, have more room in the roof because you don't have those pillars there. So there's more headroom. And even on the Polestar 4, you know, you can recline the seats in the back, which is sort of unusual. And so,
that's
like,
cool.
you know,
yeah.
there you have like a really spacious. And I was like, honestly shocked. Like, I'm 6 foot tall and I have no issues. I have so much legroom in the back, no issues with headroom. And so, you know, there is a little, you know, logic to the madness of, hey, let's just ditch the rear window and kind of embrace technology. I think this is a good
yeah.
way of, like, you know, yeah. Polestar is a very tech-forward, design-forward company, and they're kind of planting a flag and being like, hey, this is what we're doing. Look, if you are anxious about it, maybe this is not the car for you, but for, you know, a car that's kind of embracing this, you know, kind of tech-first design, mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting approach.
It's worth talking about who Polestar is. You know, people may not be totally familiar with it. Like, Polestar, so is the sort of like higher end brand attached to Volvo, and they're both owned by Geely, which is a Chinese car maker. So mm-hmm. the really interesting thing about Volvo, and I've talked about this before, and I have become Volvo pilled because I was obsessed doing car research for like safest stuff. Volvos historically have been super safe, but the new ones also have great tech, like ever since the like 2014 refresh since Geely bought them. So I'm really digging Volvo. I love like their cabin design, their philosophy and everything. And Polestar is like the higher end of that. So the seats and everything look very similar. I love, if you look at like crash videos, Sam, on YouTube of like, you know, different speeds of how a car.
Oh yeah, Volvo always kills it. Yeah.
Volvo kills it because like the actual cabin is just like it's like a cage. It's a steel cage that keeps everybody totally safe compared to like what you see from a lot of manufacturers.
And then they
so,
just stuff
yeah.
it with like more airbags than like yeah. you would think is possible.
So by ditching the rear window, you kind of make a more solid cage in the back too, if you're rear-ended. So that's a thing. Although I'm sure repairing the repair would be even worse and maybe more annoying. Repairing windows if you're in a crash is bad, but repairing like the camera and everything too. Like it's just a whole different thing. Everything's going to be more expensive. So you sat in this thing, you saw this thing. How are you feeling about it, Sam?
I mean, I was, you know, they had the rear view system working and people were walking by and I was like, hey, yeah, this, yeah. this looks totally fine. I don't have issues with it. But obviously, you know, in Gadget and, you know, probably a lot of our listeners are probably like, you know, a little bit more on the savvy side. And so they might not have the same issues as like, my parents or, you know, some older generations.
Is there a button to switch between actual rear in cabin view versus rear external view? Because if you have kids in the backseat, like maybe you want to flip on to see them in the car seat or something.
I don't know. I'm not even sure there's like a rear passenger view. It's just dedicated to like the rear view.
There has to be. Knowing what this company's doing, like Chrysler and everybody else is putting cameras facing in the cabin in the rear. So I'm sure they can do something like that. Yeah. There's probably a camera inside too. This is a cool car for Polestar.
It's also going to be the fastest Polestar yet. So the single motor long range version is going to get about 300 miles of range. The dual motor one is going to get about 270-ish, but that dual motor one can go 0 to 60 in 3.8 seconds, which Polestar says is its fastest car yet.
That's pretty fast. I mean, everybody, that is the thing about EVs I'm a little wary of. Like, I don't think regular consumers need a car that can go 0 to 60 in 3.8 seconds. You know?
Oh, no, and probably not. And
everybody's pushing that thing.
Yeah, and, you know, the base model, I think it's about 7 seconds, 0 to 60, which is still surprisingly fast. And I think the big thing is, like, you know, if you've driven an EV, you know that all EVs have that like instant torque, so you always mm-hmm. get like really great throttle response. And it's kind of funny that you mentioned that, because as part of that EV forum that I went to earlier, one interesting stat that I think JD Power trotted out is that anyone who test drives an EV is 50% more likely to actually buy an EV. And so that was like one of the biggest like deciding factors is, have you driven an EV or not? And I think that is like a very, like, once you try it out, you instantly see the difference between gas and EVs. And then that actually changes how you think about them and makes, you know, probably in a lot of cases, as, you know, like JD Power said, makes you at least more open to the idea of, you know, switching from one platform to another.
Were there any conversations at the auto show about like the downside of EVs? That's probably not the forum where they'll talk about it. But right now I'm seeing from researchers and scientists, like, EVs are great, certainly better than, you know, internal combustion engine cars, ICE cars, as they call them now. But there are still, like, there's the battery minerals that we're dealing with. There are the emissions from the tires, kind of like the stuff that gets rubbed off of tires when they're driving around. And EV tires are extra, they degrade faster because EVs are heavier and they have the big batteries and everything. Was there any discussion about like those impacts around EVs?
Yeah, there was definitely a little bit of that. Some of the dealerships and some of like the governing bodies for the dealerships were like, hey, you know, we need to make sure that we have the infrastructure to support this influx of EV buyers. And that in terms of like having, you know, dealers having the right testing equipment, I'm sure there's been, you know, we've heard stories about, you know, people driving their EVs or getting calls from their dealerships like, hey, you need to come in for an oil change. It's like, okay, come on now. Like, I mean, that's just like, you know, low-lying stuff, but it's just like, you know, you want to make sure you have the right training for any repairs that need to happen in that nature. And then, you know, people were also talking about, you know, China definitely has a lead in terms of like supply chains for batteries and rare earth minerals. And so, you know, US still needs to catch up to that. And you can kind of see this by like, you know, some of like Toyota's approach to EVs where like, you know, they're diving more on the hybrid side because, you know, hybrids still have batteries and they get more kind of usage out of the smaller batteries in a hybrid in terms of like doing a full BEV where you have like, you know, 100 kilowatt hour battery. And then, you know, you could make, you know, 5 or 6 hybrids with the same amount of batteries that you put into a single BEV.
But then you're still relying on gas for the rest of their stuff too, right? Like Toyota, I think, has been rightly criticized for dragging its heels into full EVs, but also like for actively pushing back against Japan and other countries, like going more into EVs too. Toyota's big thing is like, oh, we're working on hydrogen, right? That just emits water. Therefore, we are a good company. Even though hydrogen is a tech that's like, that's never going to happen. We don't have any way to like deliver it. It's
right.
It
if you really live outside of California, there's basically no options for like hydrogen filling stations.
I'm still mad about that because I'm a former Toyota owner. I was like, this company generally knows what's up. Like, this was like the Nintendo of the car industry. But no, on some level, they're just like just as crappy as like some of the others. It's not as bad as like Volkswagen's Dieselgate scandal. But certainly they have done their own to like push back against like actual innovation in the car world because they're so comfortable with hybrids.
And the thing is that like they're almost sort of being rewarded for it because Toyota sales have been doing gangbusters because and you know, it makes sense that like hybrid is sort of like the middle ground approach. It's not as scary as a full EV and, you know, they still get great gas mileage. Obviously, you are still using gas, but so there, it's definitely a very planned business strategy for Toyota to sort of like they're sort of fence sitting in a way.
It feels like they're just dragging it out as long as they can. So like they just want a little bit of ice action, you know, that plug-in hybrids or any hybrid will be better for Toyota in the long run because they're cheaper to make too, right? And the infrastructure is all there. Did you see any other cool cars? I know there was a new Kia that looked very cool. That's a gas car, but the K4 looks very cute, and I really like the wagon version of that. We don't see enough wagons over here.
Yeah, so the K4 is from Kia is a gas car, so you know, but it's like super affordable. I think it's going to start at under 30,000, and there is going to be a wagon version, which you know has historically not sold well, but the people who love wagons, they really love wagons.
We gotta have like a wagon reckoning in the US because every time I walk by when I'm like, man, that is nice. It is nice to be a little lower to the ground and still have a ton of storage and stuff.
I think for
family stuff. Yeah.
The issue is just like a trend thing because people just love like the shape of EVs and like the slightly higher driving position where you feel, you know, a little bit taller. I mean, I think, you know, it's a lot of people like they just want to feel taller in general, so that kind of carries over.
This is true. I tested that the Kia EV6, which is their like it's a compact SUV. I'd call that one, and just trying to sit in it, like trying to reach in to climb into it, is a problem because I am I'm feeling it in my back and in my bones, and like trying to climb into a car, and I just turned 40, and it's like
just feeling a little stiff sometimes.
I don't want to do that. That's not actually very comfortable. It's nice to just like glide into a seat, but I will say the most comfortable I've ever been was in like minivans, and minivans are still pretty low to the ground compared to SUVs and trucks and everything. So, you know, we're working on stuff, and it looks like that K4 looks very similar to their EV models, so I'm surprised Kia is kind of bringing the design down to the ICE cars.
Yeah, I mean, Kia's been, I think they redesigned their logo, and then like they, you know, the EV9 is like a very striking design, you know, very modern, futuristic. So it seems like they're kind of like, you know, going through the cycle, like doing a big modern refresh for a lot of their models. And then I also saw the Acura ZDX, which is kind of Acura's take on an EV SUV. It's based on the same platform as the Honda Prologue and the Chevy Blazer EV. So this is not a self-built Honda EV platform. And that is kind of an issue. There's been a lot of news about how the Blazer EV platform had a lot of software issues on launch, and they actually paused sales. And then I think they're kind of ironing it out. That said, Honda, you know, I've heard reports that, like, you know, based on test drives, the Prologue is like, you know, a lot more stable, and Honda, you know, generally a little bit well known for, you know, really ironing out a lot of those issues. That said, I think the Prologue is a better looking version of than the ZDX.
Than the ZDX. I mean, Acura's designs have been so boring, so dull for so long. Like, they got rid of the ugly like tooth thing, like the tooth logo, the design. I'm still annoyed. Again, Toyota disappointed us by dragging their heels into EVs. Honda was just like, we're going to be slow on hybrids and EVs. We're just going to be slow on everything, and we're going to rely on Chevy, you know, for this whole thing, or Chrysler.
Although one thing that is cool that Acura is doing is that with the purchase of a ZDX, you will have a choice of three bundles. So you can choose to have a bundle where they will install a level 2 charger in your garage. You can also choose a bundle that has a bunch of different charging cables so that you can like stash in the car and make it easier to charge.
That's cool.
Or you can choose a third bundle that is just a bunch of EV charging credits that you can use at public chargers. So it's nice to see that, like, you know, they're at least thinking about trying to make the process of owning an EV a little bit more a little bit less stressful.
I think a lot of people aren't aware of like how annoying it is to get a charger installed in your house. Like, I moved down to Georgia to, you know, to finally buy a house with my wife and for our whole family. And it's not an old house. It was built in like 1995, but to get the power line to the garage to actually do that will cost like close to, just to install the actual power, is like $2,000 to $3,000 because you have to run the power line. Then,
and then you're paying another $500,000 at least for the charger itself.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's crazy. So, yeah, I can imagine. Did you see any other cool EVs? Because this seemed surprisingly light on overall EV news at this point.
Yeah, there. You know, as far as gas cars, there's like a new Infiniti QX80. There's a Nissan Kicks. The Kicks is kind of a nod towards they kind of took inspiration from shoes, which is not something that has not been done before in cars. But that was kind of the goal.
Do you want to drive a shoe? Okay.
Yeah, it's just more in terms of, like, you know, they want it to look sporty and athletic, and some of the materials, at least on the interior, are, like, you know, something that, like, you might see from Nike or Adidas or whatever. Hyundai refreshed the Tucson and the Santa Cruz, but, you know, those are, you know, traditionally gas cars. There was a new version of the IONIQ 5. This is the N line or N version, and it's got, like, a cool new paint job, and it's got, like, up to 641 horsepower, including, like, a boost mode. So if you, like, you really need an EV that's like super fast, and 0 to 60 in 3.1 seconds. So like,
stop.
Really super fast. Obviously, this one's going to be pretty expensive. Like, you know, a lot more expensive than the standard base IONIQ 5. But it's nice to have it if you, you know,
it's love nice.
A big hot hatch-ish thing. That's also an EV.
I think we need to have a larger conversation about EV excess about these cars, because the thing is, it's very easy to just put in, you know, a really powerful electric engine that will get you, you know, will get you that fast launch, but also the torque is so instant. I'm definitely worried about, like, normal people who are not used to controlling a car like that, right? It's like putting somebody behind a Ferrari and they stamp down on the accelerator and they have no idea how bad it could be. Or if they'll just slam into somebody in front of them, like, yeah, it's a thing. Anything else you want to mention from the auto show, Sam?
Yeah, real quickly, it was the 60th anniversary of the Mustang, so Ford showed off a rally version of the Mach-E, and there's also a new bronze appearance pack with, like, you know, really cool eruption green paint. The rally Mach-E has this, like, absolutely massive wing, and I'm not even sure what it does, but go look at pictures. It's kind of wild.
It needs to go up and down. That's all an EV wing should do.
Yeah. And then Genesis brought a couple concepts. The thing that I thought was the coolest was the Neolune concept. And this is like a big, like, super premium luxury EV concept. And on the outside, it's, like, you know, very sleek and futuristic. But on the inside, so on the dashboard, there was like at least a 15, maybe 17 inch wide display that rises up from the dashboard. So that was really cool. The front seats spin around, so it kind of looks like, you know, a first-class airline seat. And then in the back, as, you know, someone who loves flexible displays, they had not one but two flexible OLED displays that will kind of tilt down to get in the passenger's face. But then if you don't want it there, it kind of tilts back up and, you know, sits flat against the roof of the car. So obviously a concept, you know, car companies love making these far out things that we'll probably never see production, but hey, it looked cool, and, you know, very opulent, but also kind of techie, which I appreciated.
It's kind of cool. We saw some news this week about, Tesla's, like, self-driving push. Was your report that, new Tesla deliveries will include a self-driving demo, which will slow down delivery times. But also all Teslas are getting a month of full self-driving, level 2 self-driving starting this week, looks like. Any thoughts on that, Sam? I don't know if you've experienced the self-driving or...
Yeah, I mean, I've had a chance to try out self-driving on Teslas, and I actually think this is a good idea for two reasons. The less, like, you know, attractive reason is that it maybe pushes more people to buy the full self-driving package from Tesla. And so it's good for Elon's bottom line.
A $12,000 package, by the way.
Right. Thank God. But I think more importantly, I think people, when they're buying a new car, especially if they don't have a ton of familiarity with the category, it, you know, if they're forced to take a demo of the technology, then they just get a better sense of, hey, here's what the technology can do. Here's what it can't do. And we've seen so many stories about people, like, driving down the road, just, like, kind of not, you know, no hands on the wheel. They're doing their makeup or, you know, they're playing games or reading a book or whatever. And, you know, it's like that is not – you still have to pay attention even when you're using full self-driving.
Hands on the steering wheel. Like, be aware. Be ready to, like
– And so I think it's good that, like – hey, new car owners will get a demo about how to use their car and what it can do. I think that's just, you know, practical, good salesmanship in terms of, hey, let's make sure the customer is familiar with this huge, expensive hunk of metal that is going to be driving down the streets that they're going to be in charge of.
Although I think the demo is only for full self-driving and not for like all the other stuff you have to learn in a Tesla. Like the first time I drove a Tesla around, like the fact that it's basically one pedal driving by default is weird and jerky, because as soon as you take your foot off the accelerator, it like lurches to a stop, and like that whole thing can be tweaked. Just turning on your wipers is a whole journey. I feel like, yeah, car makers should just be doing this training in general for people, but that requires time and effort. So I don't know. Do you have a big tutorial on your in-car infotainment system to explain everything to?
You know, in theory, it's good. Elon himself was saying that like this might, you know, slow down sales, but this is like the one thing that Elon is doing that like kind of, you know, sacrificing a little bit of money for a better, you know, customer experience. So
I feel like they should have been doing this like since they have been talking about any sort of self-driving, and Tesla's still under fire using the term full self-driving, because it's very unclear like what they can actually guarantee. Like, are the LiDAR sensors back, or are they still like relying entirely on cameras for this?
Still relying entirely on cameras.
That's ridiculous. That's insane. So yeah, I can see why Tesla is doing this to prove that the tech works, but still a huge expense. And I don't know. I don't know if it's like really worth it for anybody, especially when like the default very smart cruise control stuff can be pretty good. It's good on other cars. So I rented a Hyundai last year that was able to like at least stay in the lane and follow cars just fine. And for a lot of people, that'll be enough. But cool, Sam, like where is your car searching journey going? Because I know you've been thinking about it for a while.
Yeah, I'm getting a lot closer. I think, you know, we're probably going to buy a new car this year. And, you know, the first decision was like, do we go EV or hybrid or, you know, regular gas car? And like, I really want an EV, because I think, you know, we talk so much about it that like, you know, I just need to have something to like experience the, you know, more deeply the pain of charging, you know, because I don't have a
You could probably get a good plug-in hybrid like pretty easily. My thing to everybody is like, for the love of God, you don't. The whole new car appeal, I think, is insane given how quickly cars like depreciate. Like it's
right, and so
we've a lot. Yeah,
we've already decided that whatever car we buy is going to be a used car. Just because it's like, I mean, there's the, you know, the environmental factor. Hey, if you're buying a used car, you're not, you know, putting another car on the road, and you're reusing that something that's like, you know, kind of sitting around a lot.
Pro tip: like a 3-year-old used car is still very new, will still feel very good, especially if it's coming off of a lease or something. They are usually not like very heavily driven, and you still get most of the latest tech. You just don't get like the very, very latest stuff, but you save, you could often end up spending like half the money, you know, that car originally cost. So that is the smart way to go. I think with EVs, it's going to be more and more confusing, but I don't know. Like Tesla sucks as a company, and Elon stinks as a leader. But also, I'm such a deal hound where I'm like, you could probably suck it up if you find a Model Y or something for a decent
right.
sale.
And so that's really what it's going to come down for us, is like, can we find a good deal? And the other thing, like, you know, where I'm kind of cognizant of is that like, I want to get if we're going to get an EV, I want to get an EV that has at least 300 miles of range, or, you know, around about there, instead of like some of the base models that have like closer to 250. Because especially for an older car, everybody knows, you know, batteries, you know, kind of. The charge deteriorates over time. And so, you know, if you factor in like, you know, 5%, you know, battery deterioration over a few years, then, you know, you want to make sure that you have some excess, you know, wiggle room in terms of like your overall range.
And in cold weather, that mileage is actually even much less. So that's the thing. I would say it depends on how often you want to do like road trips and stuff, right? Because 200 miles of driving is about 4 hours. And if you're going on a road trip with kids, you probably want to take a break every 2 or 3 hours, honestly.
Yes, so totally.
It does kind of work out that way. Also, don't look down on the like super small battery cars. Like the Nissan Leaf is a really cute car, really cheap car. You could buy that thing for under $20,000 now. And if you only do in-city driving or like very local driving, that could be all the car most people need. It's a good secondary car or something too, if you have a gas car already. So we've got a lot of options now. But yeah, Sam, looking forward to hearing about your journey towards cardom. Or I don't know, like, will you even do that while you're still living in a city, or will you wait till you get to the suburbs for that? I don't know.
Oh, we're not. Yeah. I'm not moving anytime soon. So okay. Yeah, it'll happen way before that.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you for the report, Sam. Check out Engadget.com for all of Sam's coverage from the New York Auto Show. Now, I know everybody misses Sherlyn in this episode, but you can hear a bit of her in this interview she did with Lucy Liu. Lucy Liu is starring in a new VR game called The Pirate Queen. It's about a very famous Chinese pirate.
Hello, it's me. Hi, it's a Sherlyn cameo in the middle of this episode. So like the Vendress said, I got the chance to interview Lucy Liu this week and talk about a VR game called The Pirate Queen. This is a game that's put together by Singer Studios, voiced and executive produced by Lucy Liu. It invites players to be kind of taking on the role of this 19th century pirate named Cheng Xi, or in Cantonese, Cheng Xi. I'll also say that like I got to do a little bit of a hands-on with the Pirate Queen right before my interview with Lucy and Eloise Singer, and it's basically like a room escape game, except for in VR. So you'll be able to see your hands, pick up items, try to fit keys in locks. And it's exactly the sort of game that I play in my free time. So I enjoyed it. I also really enjoyed this rowing mechanism that you had, like, had you row with the two controllers, row a boat across the sea to a ship, which I thought was really fun, as well as climb up a rope ladder, which was pretty cool as well. So it's nice to meet you both. This is not the first time hearing of the game, but I think it's the first time it's coming out to be available for download this week. You've won the awards at Tribeca. I've played a little bit of it downstairs. So my first question really is kind of what the process was like putting this game together. When did Lucy get involved? Was it at the very beginning or not?
It's a great question. So we started developing it end of 2018. Mm-hmm. And we actually started developing it as a film to begin with. But when the pandemic hit, mm-hmm. we didn't know what the future was going to be. So mm-hmm. we then pivoted and I reached out to a friend of mine, a guy called Dr. Dave Ranyard, who used to be the head of PlayStation Studios in London. And I said, Dave, I've been thinking about the Pirate Queen, and what if we made it into a game? And he was like, I think that could be a really cool idea. And I was like, you could literally climb up the side of rigging on a pirate ship. You could discover moonlit cabins. You could row across treacherous water. You know, it would be an amazing experience. And so from there, we got some funding from the Creative England in the UK, which is a public body, and we made a short version of the game, which then premiered at Raindance Film Festival, and we mm-hmm. won Best Debut at Raindance. And then we showed that to Meta, and they were like, this is amazing. And we were like, great, thanks so much. And it was kind of one of those bizarre moments where I'd never made a game before, but seemingly everyone was really enjoying it, mm-hmm. and everyone wanted more. So then we developed the full version of the game, and when we got accepted into Tribeca, we reached out to Lucy's team, and that's when Lucy
the rest is history.
And the rest is history.
But not forgotten history.
Indeed.
Yes. You're bringing it back.
I'm bringing it back to Chengshi, who was forgotten and a historical figure that was never really recognized for being the most powerful pirate in history. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something that I learned when this project came along, and I was so shocked and excited because I just, it seems so crazy that in the 19th century, this woman who started as a courtesan would then rise to power and have this fleet of pirates that she commanded, as well as creating laws for gender equality, men mm-hmm. and women, equal pay, mm-hmm. Equal status, also creating this treasury system of where the loot would be, and then she would, you know, distribute it equally. And that's basically banking. Mm. So she was really ahead of her time, and she also, it's an underdog story. Mm. So learning about that, I don't know, it's fascinating and so surprising.
Yeah. So when Singer Studio reached out to you, you were like, hell yes, I'm in. Or was it like you did a little bit of research or like, oh, even more?
I talked about it. I mean, I never really, I sort of really think about things beforehand and look into it. And it seemed so unreal to me that I, but the more I looked into it, the more fascinated I was.
Yeah.
And I mean, I came in on the easy part because they had been working on it for so many, 5 to 6 years.
Yeah.
So much research, so much time and effort and pivoting, et cetera, going into it, that once I came on board, we worked together for the voiceover. And it was just a really natural bond that we had.
I was curious as to, like, what led you to look at the Pirate Queen Cheng Xi as a figure, because
like you said, she's been forgotten. I know she's appeared in some other like pirate-themed games over the years. Yeah. What led you to discover this character in history?
She also appeared recently in a Doctor Who episode.
Oh! In fact. Sorry.
Look at that.
Yeah, I know, right?
We gotta thank the BBC.
Yes. Yeah. But yeah, no, it was a friend of mine who first told me the story, and she literally said, did you know that the most famous pirate in history was a woman? And I was like, that can't be true, can it? And she was like, no, I promise you it is. It was a woman in 19th century China who married the leader of a fleet. And when he mysteriously died, she took over and commanded about 70,000 people during the lead up to the Opium Wars and became the most powerful pirate of all time.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is extraordinary. And then as Lucy says, you know, I looked into it further and the fact that she paved the way for gender equality and she literally created this law that meant that men and women had to be treated equally was amazing. And I think from then, speaking to my friends and saying, you know, who was the most powerful pirate of all time? And they would say, oh, it's Blackbeard or it's Johnny Depp from Pirates of the Caribbean. Fictional. And I was like, yes. And I was like, that's not true, but, you know, nice try.
Yeah.
But it was this idea of this incredible woman being at the forefront of leadership at a time where it was so difficult for women to be seen as equals was...
Or to be seen, period.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was so inspiring. And I just figured that if I was a kid growing up and I knew that a woman was the most powerful pirate in history, that would hugely change my perception of gender roles and gender dynamics. Yeah. So, yeah, that's how it all began.
I do have a note on how we refer to her as Jingxi, which is like a derivative of her husband's last name to begin with. Coming into this character and coming into this game, you're a woman in a...
You don't even have your own name.
Exactly. Yeah. You're Mrs. Chang, basically.
Yeah. Well, you're the wife of, and then you're Mrs.
Exactly.
You know, which is the upgrade.
You're
so,
right.
I mean, the fact that she really accomplished so much is... Yeah. Miraculous in that time.
Chapter one does actually expand on that of like how when she married him, she demanded like equal, you know, sharing the leadership. Mm-hmm. How much of your experience as a woman in what I see as a traditionally male-dominated field, tech, VR, and filmmaking, how much of that added to the experience of creating this game?
I mean, it definitely fueled my passion.
Yeah,
100%, because it is. It's such a male-dominated space, and it's hugely challenging to do anything, to be honest with you. Even just raising finance for a game as a woman is incredibly challenging. Yeah. Raising finance for a game that has no combat in it is pretty much impossible. So it was huge. And I think we took a lot of creative risks with the project because we wanted to ensure that it was historically accurate and it was factually accurate. And we didn't want to have these combat elements that traditional VR games do have. And that was a challenge, but at the same time it was so rewarding to be able to create that game and to win Tribeca and to get this traction with a project that ultimately hopefully is paving the way for a change in perspective.
I mean, in some ways I think this project is a bit of an underdog as well because of those factors. And you know, one thing that I discovered along the way is that they, when they went to put the hands in, they had no female hands. They had to create those female hands, which tells you a lot about what they think the audience is and who the audience are.
Yes.
And so that's like, wow, that's really shocking.
It is.
That they had to create female hands and, you know, get the fingernails dirty and create this bespoke jewelry. And I mean, that to me is kind of wonderful because they are also paving the way.
Yeah.
Not unlike Chengshi to really start something new.
Yeah.
It's different.
What was your experience with VR like before this, Lucy? And then Eloise after.
I mean, for me, I just didn't... I never really played video games. I went to the bowling alley and, you know, played pinball and things like that, Pac-Man. But it never was, like, the thing that I would get involved in because it just didn't have enough quarters. But I really... What I think is wonderful about this is that it's didactic, but it's immersive. So you're doing something and you're learning something without learning. And I think I would have been a much better, like, experiential learner. And I think this would have been great because when you ask a question like, what did you use and what did the key look like? I mean, those are things that are based in historic fact and research. And I think it's nice to see and to learn and be part of that as opposed to let's turn to page 48. let's read 16 pages. Now give me, you know, and then spew up, you know, write a paper on it. It's like, yeah, that's not as exciting as doing something and being actively part of something.
Right, right. You know? You'll remember her story more clearly now than reading it from
Well, because you are that person. You're living that person's life or that moment in time. And it's sort of like, that's what you're going to remember because it becomes part of your body when you're moving around.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the player has the agency. They're the one that's discovering the story. They're uncovering what's happening and the factions and everything that she has to face, the challenges. And that's so exciting. That's why I think VR is such a compelling medium.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. There's a lot of talk about VR's potential as a medium for education, for, you know, empathy as well, and some people, therapy in that space as well. I'm curious both of your perspectives on this. Was it harder to create content for VR, and therefore was it harder also to voice a character in a VR game? So I guess you guys decide who goes first.
I think VR, to me, was something that was new. Mm. And for me, the direction that I received from Eloise, which was such a relief, was to just be very subtle and be quiet.
Yeah, you're right in my ear.
And I think it's like you're not, it's sort of like you're talking to yourself. So that's the whole role play, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And that was nice because normally you can go in there and you can lose your voice. You know, you can scream, you can shout.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this is very different. This is just, you're actually, this is the most real you can be, because normally if you're in the theater, you have to, you know, make sure that they can hear you at the back row, and but at the same time you're just asking for orange juice, you know. it's not the same. And so it's really, to me, it was the most naturalistic performance I could ever give.
I love that.
In that experience, because it's also in a sound booth.
Yeah.
And also iconic. Like, so Lucy is amazing in this game, literally amazing. And everyone who puts on the headset literally says, like, oh my god, she's incredible. I'm just like, I know. It's
so true. Kudos for all the, like, one of my biggest peeves with Hollywood and entertainment in general is when Mandarin words or Cantonese words are not pronounced the, like, original way and kind of bastardized almost. And, like, hearing that really lent to it for me because I speak both, and it's like, I get really annoyed.
I don't blame you. It's hard. We had a coach for the dialect for the Cantonese, because I don't speak Cantonese, but it is very specific. Mm-hmm. It has many more tones than Mandarin, and you know, we wanted to be accurate about it, or have somebody dub that in, because I was like, I don't want to be bastardizing that. I've done that before where they, last minute, were like, we're not going to do it in Mandarin, we're going to do it in Cantonese. I was like, wait a minute. I don't speak that language, and I can't just, you know, it's like telling me to start speaking German, which would have been easier to do than Cantonese, because it's written in you know, alphabet, in the alphabet, but in phonetic. I was, so we wanted to be very specific about that, and I was like, this is, we have to be accurate about it.
That coach did great because, the pronunciation sounded accurate to me, and I was like, oh, Lucy speaks Cantonese too. Great.
Please, thank you. I'm so embarrassed, but I don't. But, like, I will take your compliment.
My
because
parents would love it.
It's mortifying.
Oh, no. I mean, Ethan, great. And I think the paying attention to the detail that way is just so helpful to the immersive experience. I think all the more, like you said, the intimacy of the voice in your ear and then having it all pronounced correctly, at least for someone like myself who's familiar with the language at least, It really transports you. And then the things that you talked about, the different motions of, you know, putting the incense in the incest, like, pot, and going through the, I haven't met with the person that's supposed to meet me in my cabin yet, but I can't wait. I think all of this, you know, I've seen other VR games. I've tested quite a few. Supernatural is a great one because it, like, gets you to move around a lot as another meta title. But this is exactly the sort of game I play. It's the puzzle game. It's room escape. It's, I've played those on the browser. But to have that, the mechanics of the picking up and putting down
with your actual
controller, with the hands in the game.
How does that feel?
You've mapped it so well to the actual elements that, like,
it's not like over there, but it's here.
Sometimes you pick up a paintbrush and it's just not painting what you're doing yet. Sometimes it's, so, like, how much work did you put into that? How important was it for you to get those elements correct as well?
Hugely. Yeah. I mean, it was sort of one of the foundations that we started with, was to ensure that we were creating something that was as historically and factually accurate as we could possibly get. And it was so important to us as a UK-based company, if we were going to be telling a story of a different culture, we needed to be able to get that right. And so we worked with Maya Bodenstein as our writer, who specializes in culturally accurate stories. She's half Chinese and half German, and she's an amazing writer. And we brought on sensitivity checkers and fact checkers, and every iteration of the game was checked and double checked. The wording, how everything is written, to the fact that when we first designed the game, we built the ship with wooden planks and nails, thinking that any ship would be built with wooden planks and nails. And then quickly we realized, we sent it to our researchers to check, and they were like, well, actually in China at the time we used dovetail joints. Oh. So then we had to remove every single nail from every single ship and replace it with dovetail joints. And it's because if you're going to be creating a story, you have to be doing it properly. And in VR, it's such a immersive experience that everything needs to feel like you're stepping back into that place in time.
It was really enjoyable for me to row the boat, by the way. Yeah.
Eating one of your
hands. That boat rowing I've like, never done.
Oh, yeah. Good workout.
Right?
It's quick, yeah.
Yeah. I think there's going to be a hashtag called hashtag pirate fit. And you have to...
pirate fit.
Yeah. Because it's such a workout, literally. You row, you climb up the side of the ship, you climb up to the crow's nest. I mean, I got proper biceps from this.
Oh, yeah. That's what it is.
That was your workout.
That's how she got her biceps.
That's how I got the biceps.
I don't know how we're doing on time, but I wanted to get some gadget-related questions in very quickly for both of you. So Engadget's celebrating our 20th anniversary this year. We've been around for a bit, and this might seem like an obvious question, but I want you to think about it. What piece of technology in the last 20 years would you say has either changed your life the most or impressed you the most?
I have to say, because I don't have a lot of gadgets, so I'm more limited than this young lady here. I think the iPhone has really transformed the way that I live my life. I do try to put it away as much as I can, but I think that it has simplified your life, makes it so much easier to record memories, to record thoughts, to write down things, to communicate, to express, to be a part of something, and also to turn off as well. I think having news and being able to communicate that way has been you can learn more faster. And, you know, I think back in the day for me, it was like microfiche, you know, let's look at like, that's how long ago I was, you know, studying and writing papers. And it's just so different, even a flashlight, you know, things that are simple like that. I find that it's so, I mean, people shoot on iPhones now because the lens is so much better than an actual camera, you know, and that really blew me away. So I don't know, it's scary, but it's also wonderful and convenient. And I feel like I need a class to learn because there's so much that's updated and changed. And I still haven't figured out, you know, the original version.
Right. How about you?
I think mine is probably a computer.
Yeah.
I can remember getting the first, you know, when we first got a computer and that experience of seeing this giant thing with the keyboard and all of it just being so clunky and huge in comparison to a tiny laptop that we have now. And how quickly tech develops and changes is so phenomenal, to the point that the Apple Vision Pro, which technically, you know, is a computer, is literally just sitting on your head. And that's remarkable. I was very lucky that Apple brought me in to see the Apple Vision Pro last year way before it was released. Yeah. And being able to see the tech for the first time and to put it on in Apple HQ and experience this, and the eye tracking and the hand tracking and just the UI and how the whole thing is set up is unbelievable. Yeah. And I literally took it off and spoke to the devs and I was like, I've never experienced anything like this. You guys are changing. You literally are changing the world with this technology.
I also think drones are pretty significant in filmmaking, as well as, you know, tracking people or criminals or, you know, it can be used for good and for bad. But the fact that it's something that is lightweight and can record or can, I mean, I don't know, that this is not something that I would have thought could have been possible this quickly.
I know.
Yeah.
Things move really quickly. So speaking of the Vision Pro, actually, I know that the game's now available in, you know, Meta's store and that sort of stuff. Any plans for broadening that in terms of not just the franchise that I think is in the works, but also other platforms as well?
Yeah, definitely. Okay. So our intention is 100% to release it on as many headsets as we possibly can.
Gotcha.
Obviously, Meta funded the game, and so releasing it on Meta is the most important thing, and I'm so grateful to Meta that they are the ones who allowed us to create this. But 100% we'll be releasing it on other headsets.
Gotcha. I got the tap, so I think that
was... You got the tap?
Yeah. I think that was it. Thank you so much.
I think we would have gotten the tap a long time ago if his hands could reach.
Thank you. I'm so far away. I'm so sorry. Thank you very much
for
your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Great questions.
Great questions.
Let's move on to other news this week. And we saw that Florida's governor, Ron DeSantis, has signed a bill requiring parental consent for kids to join social media platforms in Florida. It completely bans kids under 14 from using social media services, and kids 14 and 15 will have to basically age verify to use these services. They didn't call out any, you know, any social media platform specifically, but it sounds like anything involving infinite scrolling. So that's Facebook, that's Instagram, that's, you know, TikTok, that's everything. There are a lot of concerns about this, because to basically determine the age, it also means like age verification is becoming a thing, especially for like pornographic websites and adult websites. Also, like, that means more age verification coming, which comes in with all sorts of new privacy concerns and First Amendment concerns. And yeah, this isn't scheduled to take effect until January 1st, until next year. I think Florida is fully expecting there's going to be major pushback for this from civil rights groups. Sam, you are a parent of a child. How do you feel about, you know, a state saying no social media and you can only access it with age verification after a certain point?
I mean, my kid's 2.5, so I feel like I still have some time to kind
They're
of
getting
figure
there.
This out. But
yeah.
Like, I don't know. I am of the opinion that like parents need to parent, right? They need to be involved in their kid's life. And if you are completely checked out and you don't know what your kid is doing on social media, then you're messing up too. I think just like blanket bans of stuff it seems kind of silly. And it also seems just like philosophically very strange, because DeSantis is a Republican, which is usually the party of freedom of choice. And
I guess freedom of choice is one thing, like independence, right? Freedom to do what they want, except, you know, unless you're a woman and you're trying to control, you know, your own bodily autonomy or something, right? It's freedom to a certain extent, or freedom to basically do whatever they say. I agree with you, though. Like, this really does come down to parents being very involved. Most of your devices have age protections. You can control like what apps and things your kids have access to. You can't stop a kid from going to like the library or a friend's house and signing up for an account, you know? So that is kind of the thing that maybe they're aiming at. But this to me just feels like it won't really amount to anything. After a certain point, though, I do wonder, like, is it even possible to keep really young kids off of these platforms without leading to age verification? And age verification just opens up such a can of worms that I just don't think it's even worth it. That is basically, you're going to be sending these random like ID verification services personal information to verify yourself. These companies are not always stewards of great data. That's just, you are sending a lot of personal data to a company, and who knows what happens if they're hacked, or if anything happens, could that data be used against you down the line? It's not great. So I don't know. We don't know exactly what's going to happen from this, but this is a very Ron DeSantis thing to do, because it is a conservative flex for him, right? But I don't think it ultimately will lead to actually anything. Any other thoughts on that, Sam?
Once again, the party of small government is coming in with the big government approach, and I don't get it. It doesn't make any sense to me.
I mean, yeah, it doesn't have to make sense. They just need to be loud. We also saw news that Intel has basically confirmed that Microsoft's Copilot AI will soon run locally on PCs. Right now, when you run Copilot, if you like do a query, you're basically sending it to the ChatGPT cloud, you know, like that. It's going to the internet to actually do work, and then it sends the results right back to you. Intel also said in their remarks during their AI summit in Taipei recently that next-gen AI PCs and will require 40 TOPS of NPU performance. And this is a new standard that we're going to have to start talking about right now, because TOPS is trillions of operations per second. It is the way we've been measuring like AI performance along NPUs, which are those little like chips that just do AI work, neural processing units. And to put this all in perspective, Intel's new Meteor Lake chips, the latest ones, their NPUs offer 10 tops of performance. AMD's Ryzen Hawk point platform has 16 tops. Qualcomm's X Elite Snapdragon chips have 45 tops of performance. And those are the things people have been saying, like, they're benchmarking really well. It's going to be really exciting to see, like, what those mobile chips could do eventually. And also, there's a clearer definition of what an AI PC is now, too, according to Intel. It has to have a new GPU, comes with Microsoft Copilot built in, and it has to have the Copilot key. So if you build a system with one of these chips and has Copilot and everything, but you don't have that stupid little Copilot key on your keyboard, it's not a quote-unquote AI PC. Thoughts on any of this, Sam?
This was sort of like the logical expectation, because we've seen a similar thing on phones where, you know, a lot of mobile chips that have larger and larger NPUs, and Google especially has been kind of offloading a lot of the, like, AI and machine learning process to the local processor, not only because, hey, it's more efficient because you're not sending data to and from the cloud, which takes, you know, a lot of Wi-Fi or, you know, cellular bandwidth, which also requires a lot of power. And so it's like, it just makes a lot of sense that, like, hey, if there's things that you can do locally because you have the chips to support it, you should do it locally. And so this makes a lot of sense. It does put a little bit of pressure on Intel and AMD to, like, really beef up their NPUs because, you know, have we seen just, like, by the basic TOPS numbers here, like, they're pretty, there's a pretty big gap between the chips that are available now and what Windows or Microsoft says that it wants AI PCs to be. So we'll see about that. And it also, you know, at least it feels like there's, like, a little bit more tangible benefit to Copilot, because right now we're talking about AI on laptops and stuff, and it's like the most of what we're getting is, hey, we're offloading some of the, like, camera effects to the NPUs. And it's like, okay, that's fine, but no one's buying a laptop because it does slightly more efficient, camera effects or background blur on Zoom calls.
It's we need to be sold on more of those features. I will say, I'm testing one, a computer with an NPU right now, and the Windows Studio Effect stuff does look really good. Like, the thing about it is that it is more accurate than the software-based, like, background blurring and stuff, where there's usually, like, a big, weird, ghostly silhouette around you, and it doesn't always get your hair and stuff right. Whereas Windows Studio Effect stuff is just, like, crisp. It's very solid. It almost looks like you're actually using a mirrorless camera or something to get, like, a depth of field effect. So it does work a little better. And there are
some legitimate power savings, benefits where in terms of, like, a laptop that has an NPU will use less power, especially, which is important if you're unplugged, when you're doing those camera effects. So if you're on video meetings a lot, you could end up with, like, 2 hours of extra battery life, depending on how many calls you have. But it's, once again, it's like, it's really, you're sort of getting in the weeds in terms of, like, how much do you really care about AI in terms of, like, its applications?
Absolutely. And speaking of, like, power efficiency and things like that, Google has finally released a version of Chrome that works really well on ARM-based Windows systems. So this was, like, a big thing that I was complaining about when I reviewed the Surface Pro 9 with 5G. That thing had the Qualcomm chip from back then, and even Chrome was just, like, a pain to run. So this is going to be a big thing when it comes to, like, the Qualcomm Snapdragon X Elite PCs coming later this year. That's going to be a really interesting chip, because it does really seem like, Sam, like, that could be the equivalent for the Windows side of what Apple's M chips did, for Mac. So those have the potential to be very fast. They will have NPUs, of course. We're seeing more and more Windows apps optimized for ARM. I'm still worried about the emulation. It's the emulation of older Windows apps that really killed the Surface Pro 9 for me. Are you thinking more seriously about ARM-based Windows stuff, Sam? Because I'm still, like, super skeptical on all this stuff.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of, like, where we're at right now, is because previous Windows on Snapdragon laptops were just, they felt really rough, and you would feel them bogged down if you tried to do anything intense at all. And that said, Qualcomm has been talking a huge game about the performance of the Snapdragon X Elite, because it's based on its new Orion cores, which came from an acquisition that Qualcomm did a few years back. And so, we've been seeing really big benchmark numbers. We're seeing really big performance numbers. Even like we just talked about, NPU numbers are way ahead of what we're getting from Intel and AMD. But the thing that could really kind of put a wrench in all of this is that translation from how much software is native for ARM, which is what the Snapdragon Elite chip is. And, you know, so now that we're getting, hey, we're getting a version of Chrome that is, runs way better on ARM processors. And, you know, so it seems like Qualcomm is, in, you know, working pretty closely with Microsoft, kind of build that up, remove some of those, you know, blockers that we ran into before. And, you know, we're expected to see the first, you know, Snapdragon X Elite PCs later this year. So I think, you know, this is Qualcomm giving it another big, and, you know, Microsoft too, another big concerted effort into trying to make this Windows on Snapdragon thing really happen again.
We also saw a fun story this week about a group of researchers that have created a camera that can capture 156.3 trillion frames per second. It's a super fast scientific camera. Let's see, it's an encoding rate of 156.3 terahertz, which translates to that amount of frames per second. It's called a SCARF, Swept Coded Aperture Real-Time Femtophotography. The research-grade camera could lead to breakthroughs in fields studying microvents that come and go too quickly for today's most expensive scientific sensors. I just like that number. I saw that number of how they built this camera and the these sorts of things it could capture. That seems cool. I don't know. Sam, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, it's like that number is so big, it's like hard to wrap your brain around because, like, you know, everyone, you know, you go on YouTube and watch the slow-mo guys and they're like working in like tens of thousands of frames. Now we're talking, we're talking trillions of frames here. And it's just like the gap between those two things are just like, it's really hard to understand. So, hey, I like, you know, I'm all for it. Maybe, you know, this helps them record some like, you know, scientific experience where things are happening in like such a quick time frame that we like just literally can't see it. And so, hey, maybe this sheds some light on some of that. But yeah, like I said, this is, you know, very clearly for the high end, super high end scientific community. And, you know, I don't think it's, you know, no one's gonna be getting their hands on these at home.
Well, it's certainly not. What is cool, I see in our story that they use off the shelf components to build this thing. It's a low cost tool with low power consumption and high measurement quality compared to existing techniques. So I love it when researchers just get super, super geeky about things like that is always cool to me. And especially when this isn't like, it's not like a, you know, an electron microscope or something. Like it is simpler parts, and that's pretty cool. Let's move on to what we're working on this week. Sam, I know you're testing a couple of cool gaming laptops I've wanted to check out. So what are you? Yeah, tell us more about these.
Yeah, I'm in the process of reviewing the Asus ROG Zephyrus G14 and G16.
Nice.
You know, we saw these back at CES, and this is kind of like Asus's big refresh for their, you know, what has been their bread and butter, you know, premium gaming laptop line. And, you know, you've mentioned before, like, the design is really great. You know, you're talking about aluminum unibody chassis, and they, like, you know, these things feel like MacBook levels of quality. And, you know, they're also, you know, a little bit more sedate in their design. There's not, like, full-out, like, gamery nonsense, like, you know, too many RGB lights and all that.
The last one had the LED panel on the back of the screen, which was kind of cool, but never really amounted to much, right?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, even, you know, especially for, like, the G14, you know, I reviewed the Razer Blade 14 about a month ago, and it's, like, almost very similar build quality, plus you get an OLED screen. Not quite as powerful. The wattage on the GPU on the Asus's isn't like full fat power like you get on the Blade, but it starts at like 500 to 1,000 less. And it's like, for that, it's like, I'm willing to have like a couple minor trade-offs in performance for basically quality just as good, great display, and still pretty solid performance.
Yeah, I wrote up you wrote up a hands-on during CES, Sam, but I wrote up another one just because Asus sent me these things, and they just feel so good. Like the case feels good. The like overall build, it feels so sturdy. It feels like a huge design leap for Asus. So I'm really glad to see like them pumping this out, especially after we just looked at the ZenBook S14, I believe, the OLED version of that. And that has the old ZenBook design. And man, it looks 10 years old. It just looks like an old style laptop. And these new things feel fresh and new and exciting. Yeah. What else you got, Sam?
I mean, that's pretty much it. But I also just pubbed a hands-on of Visions of Mana, which for any, you know, older gamers who might remember Secret of Mana back on the SNES, this is Square Enix is trying to revive this franchise. And this has been 15 years since we got the last game in the Mana series, which was Dawn of Mana in 2006. So we're talking about 15 years since the last time we saw a real Mana game. And, you know, I got a chance to talk to the director. And, you know,
nice.
It seems like they're very – he told me, like, they're trying really, really hard to respect the legacy of the franchise while still making something that's, you know, engaging in 2024. And, you know, it's really interesting how they're doing that because, you know, they have the ring menu system, which is they're kind of carrying forward and reinterpreting. But you still get, like, you know, multiple characters on screen. And even back, you know, Secret of Mana was, like, one of the first, like, JRPGs to do action-based combat. And so that kind of, like, translates really naturally, too, into this new game. And plus you have, like, you know, really beautiful art, you know, bright colors, very, you know, very cutesy, kind of like, you know, Dragon Warrior, but, you know, definitely still its own thing. And as we've seen recently, like, you know, classic JRPGs are kind of having a moment. We've got, you know, the remakes for the Final Fantasy series. I would talk about, you know, I had a review for Unicorn Overlord, which is kind of like, you know, a spiritual successor to the Ogre Battle franchise. And so it's like kind of nice to see, like, you know, some of these games that I loved as a kid are kind of getting reimagined for now, but with, you know, new tech, but still kind of trying to respect where it came from. And I think that's, you know, a really tough thing to do, but when you nail it, it can come off really well. And it seems like, you know, I only got a chance to play for around 45 minutes to an hour. It was like early on in the game. So, you know, still, you know, not getting a full picture of like how deep the combat goes, how deep the story goes. But, you know, I really had a great time. And, you know, even the music is like, you get those like old school orchestral like swoons. It's like, oh man, this is really nice.
It just looks beautiful too. Like a beautiful cel shaded style that really harkens back to the old, you know, sprite art and everything. So that's cool.
Yep, absolutely.
I just dig it. I'm playing through Chrono Trigger with my daughter right now. So I'm giving her like old school RPG stuff.
All time classic.
Classic, but then we leap back to like newer stuff sometimes too. So she is going like back and forth and loving all the RPGs at this point. I think I'm doing my job right here. On my end, I'm testing the HP Spectre X360 14. This is a 14-inch convertible notebook, so it can like flip the screen all the way around. It really seems like this is the year of 14-inch laptops. Like we're just seeing more and more of them on the gaming front, on the productivity front, certainly on the like super light, ultra portable stuff too. This is a cool computer. I've liked HP's Spectre line forever. It has their like, you know, very premium design, but it's also like a nice alternative to what Dell is doing with the XPS 14.
They've always done a thing where like they've been able to split the difference between like the super minimalist MacBook, but like they, you know, still have a very premium design, but they don't look like they're copying anyone else.
They don't look like they're copying anyone else. I do feel like they go a little too hard sometimes. Like all the edges of this, there aren't any like square edges. They have to cut them off a little bit, which actually is cool because it fits in more USB ports, but They do some things. I feel like HP used to go a little too hard to be like, oh, this is bling, right? This is jewelry. This is what our design is going for. And this is not quite that, but it is a nice alternative to what Dell is doing because I don't think everybody likes the invisible trackpad on the XPS 14 and those computers. So, hey, this is like a straightforward Windows laptop. It just looks pretty cool. Let's move on to our pop culture picks for the week. What do you got, Sam?
So I'm kind of like going through all the new live action remakes on Netflix. I, you know, canceled Netflix like a while back and have recently signed up again. And so I'm watching the live action redo of Avatar, which is, I don't think it's like,
it's fine.
Great. It's great TV. You're right. It's totally fine. And it like, you know, I think it's a faithful reinterpretation of Avatar and it does that well. But, you know, I don't want to like be mean to like some of the actors because they're children, but like the performances could use a little work, I thought. But like, you know, they did pretty good with the budget. And one thing I really appreciate, especially for like, you know, a cartoon or like a video game interpretation, is that they're not skimpy about like having like lots of fire and effects. And I think if you like think about like the old, like the classic, the original Street Fighter movie, there's like one Hadouken and like one Sonic Boom in the entire movie.
The Hadouken and it's like, is also like a camera effect too. It's not even like a real special effect. They just like put a white frame in between.
And it's like, we are not going to see video game movies for the directors to be stingy about putting special effects in because that's the crap we want to see. Like we want a video game ass video game movie.
Uh-huh.
And so I think they do a really good job of like, you know, Appa looks great and like, you know, a lot of like the fire and the water and the airbending, you know, they took some time to like make sure that looked good, which I appreciate.
I think it's more like you gain nothing by watching this versus just rewatching the cartoon. And the cartoon is even a little more kid friendly because I think this show is a little violent. It's like more violent than the show is at times. I think
because of its live action, it's like it has a much more impact when like people are getting like burned
alive
or the people who are dying and they're like, you can see like very detailed skeletons and stuff like that. Yeah.
I'm still like creatively, I just feel like it doesn't really offer us much. And hey, I hated the Shyamalan movie too, but at least that one had like an incredible score. So I don't know, I have such
I mean, I think it's just for movie. I think it's for for adults who watch the original and they want to relive it, but in a way that's like, I want something familiar but new, and kind of straddles that line.
It's safe, very safe Netflix adaptations, which I think will apply to a lot of the things you're talking about probably.
Yeah, and you know, I'm planning on watching Yu Yu Hakusho, which is like a classic, you know, anime favorite series of mine.
At least that's older series. That's like an 80s series, you know? So like, reimagining that, I could see the value there.
And then, you know, I'm trying to set aside some time for The Three-Body Problem, which I know, you know, you covered a little bit. And I just, you know, I love the books and I love the, like, the idea of, like, you know, where they take some of the physics and, like, you know, how they're approaching aliens and contact and stuff like that, and kind of relating it to like even more other tech like VR and stuff like that, and how they, you know, there's a virtual world that, you know, is being used as an allegory to tell the story of, you know, expansion and like development of a society. So I haven't started that, but I'm really excited to see what it goes. And it seems like, you know, at least they're trying to put their best foot forward. They're trying to, like, you know, respect the source material as best as possible. And I think, even if it's going to be a little rough around the edges, you know, I think a lot of times that comes through in a way that, like, if you're a fan of the original, you'll probably get what they're trying to do, even if you're not completely happy with the end result.
For sure. I know people who like the Netflix adaptation of Three-Body Problem, so it's just me and a couple of critics were like, it feels too safe is the thing, but... Yeah. I want to point out, I've seen a new indie feature that is available on video on demand now. It's called Molly and Max in the Future. And this is a cool, it's sort of like When Harry Met Sally, except it's a low budget sci-fi film. And it's just really cute. It's directed and written by Michael Luck Litwack. It stars Zoe Mamet and Aristotle Athari. It's about two people who find themselves kind of have several meet cutes over a couple of years and kind of form a connection, realize that they could be good together, but spend a long time like trying to like make a relationship happen. The IMDb description says it well. It's about a man and a woman whose orbits repeatedly collide over the course of 12 years, four planets, three dimensions, and one space cult. This is a fun movie. It's a really fun, first of all, like a good rom-com. It's really funny, but also like the sci-fi trappings, I think, are very, very good and very funny. It's sort of like what Doctor Who does at times with its low budget, but the imagination behind it is so good.
It seems like it's like self-aware enough to make some of those like jokes and kind of poking fun at technology by being, you know, cognizant about what they're trying to
do. For sure. I will say, I've talked to people who I've recommended this to and who ended up loving it, but they were ready to tap out within like 5 minutes. And this is a movie where I'll say, just give it 10 minutes. Give it a little time. Get into the flow of it. It's not a super high budget affair, but I think it's really funny. And I think it's a really, you know, great experience. Also, shout out to Arturo Castro, the actor from Broad City. I think he's hilarious. And he also shows up in the new Roadhouse remake as also the funniest person in that. That movie was also a lot of fun. It's no original Roadhouse, but it is fun in its own respect. So anyway.
No Swayze, no Roadhouse.
No Swayze. Check out Molly and Max in the Future. It's available on video on demand services now. That's it for this week, folks. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find me online at Devendra on Twitter, Blue Sky, Mastodon, all those places. And I podcast about movies and TV at The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com. Where can we find you, Sam?
You can find me on X at Sam Rutherford.
Awesome. Email us at podcastengadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. Thanks, folks. We're out.